Hey, dessert listeners, I thought I would answer your questions, particularly the upper tier patron questions. Upper tier patron Louise from Colorado asks, what is the ideal age gap between siblings based on research? I just had my first baby 2 months ago, and I am curious as to what the ideal age gap between siblings is from a psychological point of view. I know that the typical age gap in America and Europe is around 3 years, but it also seems like that creates the most sibling rivalry. I read an article on New York Times that seems to suggest that either a 1 year or over 4 years is the ideal age gap for the development of each child and their relationship with each other. What is your take on this? Yeah, so there's a lot of research on this. It's fairly easy to research because you can just ask people the distance between them and their siblings and ask for certain other kinds of outcomes like high school dropout, drug abuse, crime, relationship problems, divorce, you know, attachment style, all sorts of things. And there is some data to present. It's kind of all over the map to some extent. But the thing that I would say up to your patron, Louise from Colorado, is that if you're trying to plan out your family and you're figuring out, okay, how long should I wait until I have the next child? You just had a baby and you're like, you know, what would be the ideal age gap? There are far more important factors in development of a child that would far eclipse any kind of effect that age difference in relationship. For example, when you have children that are very close in age, but you give both of them enough love and attention, and they both feel loved and take cared for and attuned to and understood and held, and each child is given their own kind of special time, maybe even every day, particularly when they're young. And that is a good strategy, actually. It can be magical at times. If you're dealing with a 4-year-old, 7-year-old who's struggling with some behavioral problems, I've worked with families where one of the things that we do is that child gets just 15 minutes, you know, because a lot of parents, they're overworked, they don't have a lot of time. Sometimes all a child needs is 15 minutes a day. Sometimes they need more, sometimes it doesn't work, but that time can really make children feel special and taken care of and like they're not constantly having their siblings or the dogs or other, or your phone is getting in the way. And so, you know, it's just one thing to think about. But anyway, so if you give your child, each child, a lot of love and attention, each child is, you know, relatively raised well, they don't go through any traumas, then any kind of effect of an age gap, the closeness in age, say 2 years difference, will be far eclipsed. So I wouldn't worry so much about that. I would worry much more about how you are planning your families, right? If some people, it's like, look, now is the time to have kids. So in the next 5 years, I'm going to have 3 kids. And then after that, I can start to plan my next phase of my life or whatever the case may be. So sometimes that'll make sense. Other times it's like, ooh, you know, one child is enough. So especially a young child. So I've got to wait 5 years before. I would take that into consideration much more than any kind of research finding about age gaps and quote unquote ideal age gaps. So that's what I'll say. The other thing I'll say about sibling rivalry is a very similar thing in that kids who, regardless of how close they are in age, but particularly if they're closer in age, and you deny them enough love and attention, then the children will start turning on each other because they see the other child as a threat to the little bit of attunement that they're managing to get. So if you're worried about sibling rivalry, it's important to pay attention to that. Each child gets enough attunement, you know, and it's another thing to think about in terms of it takes a village, right? Because one parent will be very challenged to provide enough attunement to, say, 2 or 3 or 4 young children. That's where other parents, aunts and uncles, grandparents, friends come into play, even older siblings sometimes. Upper tier patron Tiki from Seattle says, I really appreciated your deep dive on dissociation. You said that dissociation is an adaptive behavior that is learned in early childhood and can't be acquired in adulthood. Did you mean the kind that is habitual dissociation? where someone can sort of go in and out of it quite regularly or dissociating altogether. It seems to me that soldiers in combat most certainly do experience dissociation. Or are you saying an adult that would experience it as an adult during traumatic situations could only do so if they had learned it in early childhood? End of email. Yeah, it's a great question. By the way, you said disassociation. It's a common mistake that people will make. It's fine. Clinicians out there, do not say disassociation. It's not a crime against humanity, but it'll make you look like a hack. So it's dissociation. It's not disassociation. Lay people out there, say what you want. The point is that it's a good question you're asking, upper tier patron T from Seattle, that I will talk about dissociation, and we'll talk about a particular kind of dissociation or a particular meaning of the word dissociation, in that typically, clinically, diagnosis-wise, when we're talking about dissociation, we're talking about people who acquired it early in life because they were going through moments of terror and extreme anxiety and fear, and we clearly have this mechanism that has evolved to protect us from the psychological impact of trauma that allows us to check out, sometimes very much completely, sometimes in a very elaborate way, such as with dissociative identity. And so when we lock that defense mechanism into place when we're 3-4 years old, then when we grow up and we experience severe trauma, we have that available to us. Also, we might be easily triggered to dissociate when we're not actually in danger. People will come into therapy, and because of the intensity of the therapy, they will dissociate even though there's nothing actually threatening happening to them, particularly when you think about what they were going through early in life. So, yes, when I talk about dissociation, I'm typically talking about that sort of dissociation that people develop early in life, and they have it throughout their entire life. And there are treatments for it. Sometimes it's a matter of management. It's not a matter of getting rid of the disorder. And there's a lot of things one can do if you suffer from dissociation or you think you do, then find a specialist, a trauma specialist. And if you don't know what dissociation is in general, so we have dissociative identity, which I'm guessing most of you have some semblance of understanding, but general dissociation, and I talk about the different labels in the deep dive that's available to patrons, it is when we are faced with what feels like a threat, we will check out. We will become spacey. We will go to the back of our mind. We will forget or not encode memories during that time. We might become really compliant or non-responsive. And it's a mechanism that protects us from what's going on. Essentially, we're shutting down our perception. We're shutting down our ego so that, you know, we're still alive and awake and walking around, but we're not really there. And the common example that everyone goes through that is kind of in that direction is, say, you're driving to somewhere that you know very well. You're driving to work and you arrive at work and you're like, and you don't remember driving to work because you were daydreaming about other kinds of things. You weren't unsafe. You were driving and you were paying attention, but it was so mundane that you just weren't really in your body. You weren't really involved in the driving of the car because it's so routine for you. It's a similar process when people dissociate from trauma and terror. Now, there are other labels or other meanings to the label of dissociation, such as what you're talking about. Someone doesn't go through that early in life and they don't develop that mechanism. They go to war as a soldier and they experience some extreme terror and they dissociate and they won't remember what happened. You know, they'll say, I don't remember anything. Apparently I was awake and I was doing, you know, I responded, but I don't remember anything. Or a car accident, this kind of thing. And we also call that dissociation, but it's more general dissociation. And for sure, people can do that. And it is a mechanism available to us under extreme terror. It's just, and conceivably, I guess, I don't know if I've ever seen a case like this. You aren't traumatized growing up. And then the age of 30, you go through a series of severe trauma, like in the case of war. And then because of that repetitive defense mechanism kicking in under stress, afterwards, when you have a tiny stress or a much lesser stress, you will continue to dissociate because you have kind of an automatic response or an itchy trigger finger on the dissociation defense. Yeah, that could happen. I could see that happening. And maybe I have actually seen it when I think about some people, particularly people that come from war. Anyway, there's that. And there's also the other meaning of dissociation that is its original meaning from psychoanalysis and early psychology, which is general distancing that we will do. We will sometimes even consciously dissociate. Say you're in a lecture hall and you're really bored and you just start daydreaming. Well, some psychoanalytic thinkers would call that dissociation. Or if you were to have an emotion that was very difficult for you and you try to consciously or semi-consciously just deny your feelings, that could be termed as dissociation from your emotions or from yourself. So it depends on the meaning, but in that deep dive, I was talking about more of the diagnosable type. But it's a great question, and I should have gone into that more thoroughly. All right, so Femma from Discord asked a question. Dr. Kirk, in your reaction videos, you've talked about how abusive people have suffered attachment injuries or abuse themselves when they were younger. Is this always the case, or can some people become abusive without childhood trauma? If so, how could that happen? Great question. So this is really hard to measure because when we find abusive people, and what do we mean by abusive people, right? It's like, what's the line? What's the definition? But let's say we did have some way to measure that. And we had accurate information because, of course, we're not there in the home when someone's being abusive. So we have to rely on the perpetrator or the victim to tell us. And so there's a lot of issues there. But let's say we are able to identify, quote unquote, abusive people. To find the cause, we would have to, or factors that led to it, we would have to ask them questions, right? Because we weren't there when they were young. There might be some things we can point to, like criminal records or something, but there's it's really hard to find hard data on parenting issues or effects on parents. But anyway, so we have to ask the perpetrator, what was your childhood like? Did you go through abuse? Were your parents addicted to substances? You know, stuff like that. And of course, one, people don't remember things. Two, people will lie or they'll be distorted. Three, we particularly don't remember things in early childhood, 0 to 5, and that's when a lot of the damage has already been done to people. So it's hard to know. But yeah, research does suggest that some did not experience what we would call classic childhood trauma. When we ask perpetrators about their early childhood trauma or their early childhood experiences, some seemingly will accurately report that they did not go through any kind of abuse growing up. One way to triangulate this is to see if all this, you know, if all perpetrators were abused growing up, then in all likelihood, the parents abused all the kids, right, to some extent. And if all the kids are not abusive or don't have some sort of trauma effect, then maybe you just have one kid that had some sort of issue. And people will say that it's related to genetics or this kind of thing. And certainly that can be a factor. It's really hard to tease that out, though, because we just don't have the technology to do that. And the only way to do it would be to take 1,000 babies and you'd put 500 in one biodome where you raise them one way, and you put 500 in another biodome and you raise them in an abusive way, and then you release them into the public, and then you have to watch their behavior with some sort of secret camera, because of course we can't ask people to report things as we know that they might not remember or might not tell the truth. So it'd be a very elaborate study, which of course would just be massively unethical to the children and would never be done. And so we just don't know. We don't know what the cause of most of our psychological markers or traits or behaviors, because we can't experiment on it, you know, and no other animal is as complex as us. And you could argue it would be unethical to do that or no other animal is similar to us in the way that we are in terms of attachment and socializing. And anyway, point is that it's hard to know. And so whenever you see research around this, you'll see that there's a certain percentage that perpetrators that were not abused growing up. But that statistic is a little misleading because, one, we don't really know, right? Two, what do we mean by abuse? Because often what they're talking about is classic abuse. They will ask perpetrators, were you hit as a child? But we all understand there's a lot of different ways of being abused, right? You could be abused emotionally and verbally. You could see fighting in your family and be very afraid as a young child. You could be neglected. You know, there's a lot of different subtle ways that adults might not even really remember or frame as abusive. So there's that. But the thinking goes that, let's say that there was no mistreatment growing up and the family is relatively functioning well. Again, we would have no way of measuring that or knowing that, especially retrospectively. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that that was true. And you had a child that grew up in that family that ended up becoming classically abusive, you know, clearly abusive to other people. What's the thinking around that? Well, the thinking is that the individual might have been a bad match to the family. They were born with certain genetic differences, certain temperaments, or developed into someone that diverged away from what was conducive to the parenting. For example, just as a very simple one, you have a child that's introverted and parents that are extroverted, and the extroverted parents are like, how come our child won't talk to us? Or how come they're so shy all the time? Like they're, and then over time, this conflict builds up between that difference that the parents are one way and the child is another. There ends up being this feeling of animosity, although it's not abusive, and the child feels more and more isolated, starts to act out, and then the parents kind of push back a little bit, and it just kind of grows from there until the person is very unhappy and deals with things in an abusive way when they engage in attachments when they're older. So that's one possibility in that situation. You don't have any abuse, but you have what we might call a bad match, which can happen. Also, you can be oppressed and abused by society. A lot of people are, and that can constitute the grounds that one can become abusive. You know, if you grow up in a neighborhood or a community or a society that labels you, your identity as someone that deserves to be ridiculed or bullied, even if it's never directed at you specifically, but you see it in the news or on Twitter, and that causes you to feel a lot of pain and feel abused by society, then that could absolutely be a factor in becoming abusive when you're older. And there's actually some data that supports that. People from oppressed groups, don't quote me on this, I think are somewhat more likely to become abusive themselves. So because of, you know, the reasons why I said. There's other more subtle experiences that we might be able to point to, but of course we won't be able to really know that. It's just a conceptualization. Might some people literally just be born in a way that develops into a person that becomes abusive? Yeah, you can make an argument for that. There's no way to prove that, but that's typically the way people will talk. I will tell you, in my experience, whenever I've treated someone who is abusive, regardless of what degree, there is always a very easy conceptualization as to how they got there. Do I know that that's actually how they got there? No, but it seems obvious to me. You know, you have someone who is not abused classically as a child, but as an adult, they're mildly abusive, particularly verbally. And when we look back on their life, at first they might be like, oh, my childhood was fine. We look into it more, not like I'm not believing them, but we just get more elaborate descriptions. And the individual tells me about being massively criticized growing up and always feeling like they were wrong all the time. Well, that can absolutely be the factor that can lead someone down. Now, not everyone that goes through abuse will be abusive by any means, and not everyone who goes through any kind of mistreatment or criticism will become abusive. But for everyone I've treated who was a perpetrator, there was a very clear set of factors that seemed to fit for both me and for the client. In other words, I've never had a perpetrator, where I'm just like, huh, I just have no idea how this developed. I've never had that experience. All right, Sylvan from Discord asks, Dr. Kirk, are there any episodes of yours that focus on the effects of conspiracy theories and propaganda and political misinformation on families? Yeah, we've talked about it before, but maybe not specifically. We've talked about people believing in conspiracy theories and echo chambers and all that kind of stuff. But if you have a specific question, go ahead and email that in. Alex says, Dr. Kirk, what's your opinion on psychologists being given the power to prescribe medication? Yeah. So if you don't know, mainly people that can prescribe medications, Adderall, antidepressants, this kind of thing, are in the medical field, and namely psychiatrists or psychiatric nurses, right? But there's been a movement over the past 10, 20 years to allow psychologists to do this as well with extra training and extra supervision, I believe, anyway. And I think they even piloted a program in Texas or Arizona, New Mexico, or that's just coming to mind, and found a lot of success with it. The benefits to this is that psychologists typically, not always, spend a lot more time with their clients, maybe even weekly, right? Whereas psychiatrists, although they can do psychotherapy, they can conduct psychotherapy, they typically don't. They typically will see clients sometimes once every year or once every 6 months. And so it's a lot harder to really know if the medication is right for them, or I don't know, there's just a lot of things that can happen, right? A psychologist also, not only in addition to seeing someone more often, but also is trained to really get to know the full human being, to get a holistic idea, and to consider the medication as a part of their toolbox. And research, don't quote me on this, I think showed that when people went to psychologists that were extra trained, and there's a fair amount of biology training and brain training and psychotropic psychopharmacology training with a psychology doctor, which I have, and I've forgotten a lot of that, but I have a fair amount of that still inside of me, and I will talk about that. Master's level people typically don't have any of that, or they have just one class. Not to say that master's level people can't know a lot about it. They might have additional training or just personal experience. But anyway, I think research shows that psychologists tend to prescribe less than psychiatrists because the psychologists have multiple tools available to help someone. Someone comes to them who is depressed, and the psychologist could prescribe an antidepressant, but they also can provide various different therapies, talk therapies, family therapy, this kind of thing. Whereas a psychiatrist, again, some do psychotherapy, but many don't. And so when all you have is an antidepressant, then stats show that seemingly you're more likely to just it's like, well, I can't do anything else, so I'll just prescribe a med. Whereas a psychologist might, in a wise way, say, well, we don't have to go that far at this point, and you know, and it doesn't necessarily even work as well as doing these other things or a combination of everything. So now, that isn't to say that many psychiatrists and medical professionals will have teams that they work with where a therapist works with their patient and the psychiatrist does the med management. But a lot of times that just doesn't happen, or that it's not paid attention to enough. Or even if you do that, the therapist and the psychiatrist don't share enough information, so they might be going in different directions sometimes. And now, I'm not saying that model is bad. The model is fine. Psychiatry is fine, and you know, working alongside psychotherapy is fine. That works really well. But what the research seems to show is that having psychologists you know prescribe meds with extra training doesn't actually cause anything bad to happen, because that's the worry, right? It's like, well, they're not medical people. How could they possibly know what they're doing? I mean, they're messing with biology, right? That's really scary. And research, I'm not super aware of all the research, but I remember learning a lot about this and studying it 10 years ago. There seemed to be a lot of promise regarding that. Now, I don't know anything about this topic and along these lines, but I suspect, speculative, that a lot of medical professionals, particularly psychiatrists, would be threatened by this because it could interfere with their income, because maybe many of their patients would start going to psychologists instead of them. And I'm just going to take a guess and say they're not enthusiastic about that. So who knows? Anyway, next question from Discord. Eleanor says, what are the top 5 takeaways you can share from speculating about Darcy and Stacy? Yeah, I love this question. Gave me a chance to think about that, and I wrote down some things. One is that online body shaming, or body shaming in general, will take a toll on you eventually. That's one takeaway from their storyline. Another is empowering self-talk doesn't necessarily result in self-esteem. Also, without self-reflection, we're bound to repeat history. Another is one session of therapy isn't very helpful. Another one is if you want to store your money in your drawer, don't put it in a sock. Just a joke. Kofi says, thoughts on the series Many Sides of Jane on Hulu. I'm binging it right now, and it seems like a nice way to help destigmatize dissociative identity disorder. Kofi, I haven't watched it, but that would be great if we could do that, because most depictions, if not all, absolutely stigmatize dissociative identity disorder, including Split, which was a M. Night Shyamalan movie. The beginning, I thought, helped to kind of to destigmatize dissociative identity, but of course, by the end, the person with dissociative identity disorder is literally a supernatural monster, which is just a massive trope in our media, that anyone with a mental illness, particularly dissociative identity disorder, is some sort of monster, which is just like, ugh. Tweakle Cat on Discord asks, does pineapple belong on pizza? Yeah, so maybe I've already ranted about this on the podcast before, I don't know, but so if you would have asked me 10 years ago that there were a lot of people in the United States, or maybe around the world, who considered pineapple on pizza to be some sort of crime on humanity, I would have said, that's ridiculous. I've never heard anyone say that. I don't know if it's a West Coast thing or something. I mean, when I was growing up, we basically had four different types of pizzas that you would order, and you had pepperoni, you had combo, which was like sausage and vegetables and other things. It's a combination. And then you had Hawaiian, which was Canadian bacon or ham and pineapple. And then you had like mushrooms and olives, I think was another one. I don't know. There's maybe another one in there. But to me, there were three main pizzas. You had combo, pepperoni, and Hawaiian. And I just thought that, and probably every time we ordered pizza, we ordered all three. So about 5, maybe 10 years ago, I started hearing people online talking about how pineapple on pizza is some sort of crime. And it's just like, no, you don't put, and not only people saying they don't like that, but they would get up in arms about it, like it was some sort of a political point of view or something, like, how dare you put pine? And I know a lot of people are joking, but I don't, there seem to be a lot of strong feelings around it. It's like suddenly learning that if you have a car that's painted white, it is some crime against humanity. And it's like, you never have a white car. That's, you know, suddenly in my old age, I'm like, wait, so have you always thought that? And I still don't really know. Like, I've never talked really with someone that has this point of view. I'm just like, where, what planet did you grow up on? Like, was it not a thing in your town to have pineapple on pizza, or was it a thing in your town and you just hated it? Was there some meme that went around? Was there some famous person that came out against pineapple and everyone just kind of, like, one of the things that you get old enough, you start seeing these weird changes where people make these proclamations about things that were not true in the past. Like, one of the words that people have just proclaimed as being disgusting is the word moist. And there are people who say, oh, I hate that word, that's gross. Say, when we, up until 10, 15 years ago, that was just another word. And because everyone's mind is in the gutter or something, or something happened, there was a movie that had the word moist as some sort of disgusting word. I mean, even as I, because I've been affected by people, when I say the word moist, like, I get a little cringe, but I'm only that way because people have gotten into my head, because we socially construct everything, particularly language, right? And so people will make these you know, another one, a big one actually, is that clowns are scary. When I grew up, clowns were not scary. Clowns were funny and wonderful. Like, imagine a time when clowns, even like the kind of what people consider to be pretty creepy, like with, you know, like an old guy with kind of odd makeup that he just sort of slapped on and he's walking around in a parade, like those people were like Muppets or something. They were considered to be, those are, when I was a child and I saw a clown, I'm like, oh, that's for me. And we would all run to the clown. And then Poltergeist came out in the 80s, which had a clown that became a monster, and, you know, in a horror movie. And then I think It was, you know, there were John Gacy, there were these other situations that I think pretty quickly made clowns to be very creepy. And now you have people who literally have phobias of clowns, and which is fine, but then people will say that clowns are inherently creepy. And what I'll say is, no, they're not. They are clearly socially constructed to be creepy, and you have been affected by that, which is fine. Everything, a lot of things that we feel are along those lines, you know, certain foods, right? I'll have people, I'll eat kimchi like it's candy. People will have kimchi that aren't familiar with it and didn't grow up with it, and they think it's disgusting. I'll smell kimchi and I'll be like, yeah, I could see how that people think that's gross, like dirty socks, but I love the smell of sushi. My wife hates it. I can't have kimchi in the house because she'll come around the corner and be like, oh my God, what is that smell? Well, she didn't grow up with it. I did. So it's socially constructed. It's experienced. And so with pineapple, I don't know what happened. You know, did I have one of those Men in Black things that just erased some part of history to me? I don't know. So does pineapple belong on pizza? I don't know, but it's certainly great on pizza. I don't understand why it's disgusting. And then I think, well, is it a West Coast thing? You know, because Hawaiian, right? You think, well, was that a West Coast thing? And then everywhere else in the world, like, they didn't have Hawaiian pizza, which I could see, right? I don't know. You tell me. So along these lines, Stacy and I were ordering pizza. I was like, what kind of pizza do you want? And she said she wanted pepperoni and pineapple, which I was really surprised by. I lived a long time with Stacy. She's never said she wanted that. And instantly I'm like, pepperoni and pineapple, like, that's weird, but I'm all for it. Because I grew up in a family where there's four of us kids. If any of us were picky, it was immediately stamped out of us because my mom and my dad were just like, look, we can't specialize our frickin' food and menu choices to all four of us. No one can be picky in this family. And so not only were we raised not to be picky, but we were raised to actually enjoy all the fruits of the foods of the world, because I grew up not only with traditional American food, but also traditional Japanese American food, which is very different from traditional American food. You know, at Thanksgiving, we would have turkey and sushi and mashed potatoes and spam musubi. You know, it was everything. We not only had all the American stuff and more American stuff, but also all the Japanese American stuff. So I learned, and there's a lot of variance between traditional American and traditional Japanese, right? And so I learned how to enjoy food. So I don't have, you know, you put anything in front of me, I'll eat it. You know, for example, when I was really young, I claimed I was Oscar the Grouch when I was like 3 or 4 years old. And my brother, as a way of trying to troll me, was like, well, if you're Oscar the Grouch, then you're going to have ice cream with pickles on it. And I said, fine with me. And so I had ice cream and pickles and I loved it. And my brother was looking at me like, because my brother thought, oh, he's not going to really eat it. Or when he eats it, he's going to know it's disgusting. And then I'm going to have him. Like, you're not Oscar the Grouch. I ate the whole thing. It was glorious. And it's actually pretty good. I recommend it. Another thing that I love is toasted bread sandwich with peanut butter, cheddar cheese, like really rich cheddar cheese, and pickles. Trust me, it's glorious. So especially with the right bread, a good kind of grainy bread. And but people think that's disgusting, but I love it. So anyway, point is that does pineapple, my mouth is watering, does pineapple belong on pizza? To me, it does. Anyway, so we got the pepperoni and pineapple pizza, and then I posted a picture on Instagram. I've never seen so many comments. People are, you know, I love that. I hate it. You know, it's very polarizing. I've talked about a lot of things on this podcast before. I don't think I'd ever seen a more polarizing post that I've ever had. Then people were saying in the comments, they not only, you know, that's, they said, not only do I love that, but that's my favorite. They said specifically pepperoni and pineapple, which is a whole thing. I've never heard of that before. I eat a lot of pizza. I go to a lot of pizza joints. I go to a lot of pizza places. I've never seen pepperoni and pineapple. And I'm like, what's wrong with me? But then people are saying pepperoni, pineapple, and jalapeno. And I'm like, ooh. So I ordered that and loved it. So that's my new jam. All right. Good old Allie from Discord says, you've been talking about psychology in Seattle for over a decade now, but what do you have to say about pizza in Seattle? Yeah, well, what do I say? I don't think I'm going to make any friends when I say that whenever people talk about pizza in Seattle, people always bring up it's not as good as New York pizza, not as good as New York City pizza. And one, I've had a lot of New York City pizza, and it's fine. There's a lot of variance to New York City pizza. It's not like New York City is one thing. There's probably literally tens of thousands of pizza places in New York City. there's a general style that New York City pizza, and it's good. A lot of pizza is good. But I find that when people talk about this sort of thing, like for me, my favorite in Seattle is Pagliacci. And whenever I say that, because it's kind of a chain in Seattle, but it's a, I don't know, it's a good chain. And it feels of the people too, because I don't know why. It just feels like it's part of the community. It's been around for a long time. It might even be local. I'm not even sure. But anyway, point is that whenever I say anything about pizza, I always get yelled at. People will just be like, oh, you don't understand pizza. Or even people will be like, you know, Italian pizza is the best. And food is food. So, you know, people can like what they want to like. For example, when I go to Japanese restaurants, or when someone says, oh, the best sushi is so-and-so, you know, so-and-so restaurant in Seattle. And I'm like, well, for white people, but I don't say that because that's being a jerk face. You know, the sushi that is typically in American restaurants, American Japanese restaurants, is not quote unquote real sushi. It doesn't resemble it in the least. You know, you put the seaweed on the inside, which is not a thing. You deep fry it, which isn't a thing. You put mayonnaise and all sorts of sauces on it, which isn't a thing. And now it's a thing and it's fine and it's good and I've had it and I like it. But and I never say that's not real sushi, and I'm not like, well, you haven't had sushi unless you've been to, you know, Japan, and that's real sushi. It's like sushi. There's a lot of different kinds. It's not that hard to make, really. And pizza also isn't that hard to make. So the fact that there are you know, the notion that there are good pizza restaurants in Seattle shouldn't surprise anyone, or really any town. I'm guessing Houston has good pizza, and Minnesota has good pizza, and South Carolina has good pizza. Like, this notion that somehow New York City is, and it's a larger thing, and I'm guessing I have some people out there who are actually proud of New York City. You can be proud of New York City, but that doesn't mean that every other place sucks in comparison to New York City. So pizza in Seattle is great. There's a lot of different kinds. There's also Rocco's down in Belltown, which I really like. Big Mario's, I have a lot of memories going there. I think that's another part of why I like Pagliacci and Mario's and Mod Pizza, because I have a lot of memories going there, a lot of moments where little vignettes of my life of going, you know, with Pagliacci, for example, when I first moved to Seattle, because I lived outside Seattle up until I went to college, and Pagliacci Pizza was pretty close to where I was living when I went to college, and me and my friends would go there all the time, and you could get slices, right? You could get these really good slices. And so my marker for good pizza is, or at least my preferred type of pizza is, I like it to be, I think what people might call it New York style, which is that it's thin crust, but not too thin, and it's crispy. Fairly on the crispy side, actually. In fact, one of the nice things that they do with pizza and Pagliacci is when you're getting a slice, they'll put it back in the oven. They'll take the slice, put it back in the oven, and give it to you. I know a lot of other restaurants will do that too. Anyway, point is that I like that. I also like it when the sauce, I don't know how to, is it an umami thing? But, you know, like cheaper pizza is bread with tomato sauce and cheese. Good pizza, it's like, I don't know, it's like a combination, it's I don't know how to describe it, but good pizza has a richer taste, I guess, to it. I like rich tasting pizza, but I like all sorts of pizza. I like the wood fired, as long as it's crispy. I don't like, some wood fired pizza restaurants have very, you know, when I pick up the slice of pizza, I don't want the slice to go, ugh. You know, I want it, or yeah. I just, so there's that. I don't mind thicker crust pizza. I don't mind Chicago pizza. I don't have it very often, you know, deep dish. I like weird pizza. There's a place in Seattle that I really like called Serious Pie that I used to go to all the time. It's wood fired, but it's Tom Douglas. It's kind of a somewhat famous Seattle chef. And the ingredients are kind of out there. Like they'll have pear and other vegetables, and you're looking at it, you're like, that can't be good, but eat it, it's actually pretty good. And so, yeah, I love pizza in every city, including Seattle, and anyone who says that Seattle pizza sucks can go wherever they want to go. All right, Your Illusion on Discord says, what do you think of the concept of pet parents? like calling your dog or cat your son, etc. I'm a very allergic person, so I do not have any pets. However, my siblings and friends do have pets, so I am a pet auntie to many adorable animals. Personally, it weirds me out a bit when I am called their auntie, but I don't say anything because I don't want to judge. Yeah, yeah, it is weird and it is unusual. I don't remember this being a thing past maybe 10 or 20 years ago. But when I first heard it, I'm like, okay, I'm on board with that. I mean, that's how I feel about my animals. So now, you're not strange to have it weird you out, but consider it a compliment, right? That people want you to feel like you're a part of the family. Adieu says, Dr. Kirk, what are some schemas around getting really frustrated and angry dealing with poor performance employees at work? Is this associated with obsessive compulsive personality disorder? It has become a problem for me lately since I started to manage people. It's been really hard with people who don't want to do their job and then pointing fingers at me for asking too much from them. End of question. Yeah, absolutely. OCPD individuals, depending on their defensive structure, can absolutely be triggered by having to manage individuals and deal with all of their disorder, all of their messiness. So, and you could also be very principled and also a little annoyingly rigid about expectations for people. I kind of feel like I was a little bit that way when I became program director. So yeah, it could be that, or it could be just other issues. There's a lot of reasons as to why someone would have some. It could be them. I mean, it could literally be, there's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with your employees. New Relationship Energy asked the question, what is your opinion on abolition or transformative justice? Whenever I listen to you speak about conceptualization and treatment, or even feminism, disability justice, or intersectionality, your work often seems to align with abolitionist principles, transformative justice, and prefigurative politics. End of question. Yeah, well, it's complicated. Maybe what you're referring to is when I talk about bettering our society, I'm often talking about total system change. I'm not talking about addressing one tiny little thing. All right, Sylvan on Discord says, Dr. Kirk, what are your thoughts on the Myers-Briggs? I am an INFP, in case you were wondering. Yeah, well, so I've talked about this before, and I get asked this question a lot. Myers-Briggs is fine. It's useful. A lot of people like it. But in psychology, we tend not to use it. I have like one or two colleagues that will use it, but everyone else either doesn't use it or barely even knows it. For example, for me, all my knowledge of Myers-Briggs comes from when I took it a few times in my 20s, you know, a long time ago. I think I'm an ENFJ, which I think is like, quote unquote, the teacher, in case you're interested in. But the Myers-Briggs, it claims to be a measure of personality. And in order for us as psychologists to actually use a measure of personality, a psychometric of personality, it has to pass the rigor of science, and the Myers-Briggs has not in a variety of ways. I won't go into the details, but one, it's not super reliable in that people will test differently over time. Two, it's not super valid in that the claims that it makes isn't actually seen by outside research. You know, there's claims of like, well, if you're an F, then it means this. And from my memory, the science just isn't there. The one spectrum that seems to have some validity is extroversion, introversion. That is one of the, you know, that's the E or the I at the very beginning. And that seems to actually stand up to scientific scrutiny. The rest of it doesn't really seem to. And every time I remember taking the Myers-Briggs, and the extroversion, introversion makes sense. But the other spectra, I remember thinking, I don't really understand. And, you know, so now, can it be useful to people? And can people feel very seen, or that the literature around the Myers-Briggs be very helpful? Yeah. But in my field, we don't tend to use it. The other thing is, like, Enneagram is another one of those measures that people will use sometimes. And my wife took it actually recently. And it was interesting because what she told me what her results were, I was like, oh, okay, that does make sense. It was useful to me, and I think to her, to have that result. All right, well, that does it for that episode in which I answer your questions. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.